So I think first let's start with I was thinking we could start with your views on education. During the first time we spoke, I think you said you don't like to invest in ed tech companies or I don't know, something like that. It's like what is like do you invest in ed tech companies? Do you like investing in education based companies? If not, if yes, why? If not, why not so? Could you give us some context on that?
Okay, so maybe I'll start by giving a little background about myself. I am a chartered accountant who, having worked for 8-10 years in transaction advisory with the Big Fours, and then I went for my MBA. When I was doing my MBA, I realized my 3-year-old son was with me on campus at IIM Ahmedabad, and when during my MBA, I realized that he goes to a nursery class and he comes back home, plays around. There was no pressure on him at home to study, study, study. But he used to come back home and say that, okay, mama, I have to do the homework, otherwise my teacher will scold me. Okay, she'll give me a red mark, and I don't like the red mark in my book. Everybody else doesn't get it. And that kind of got me involved into what is happening in education today. Is there's too much pressure on children to study, study, study at a very young age where they are not really ready for the study or education at that point of time. That got me thinking. I opted out of my placements for 2 years. I was work involved and training under a Steiner school here in Mumbai, and that gave me a very different viewpoint on education. And the Waldorf way or the Steiner way incorporates a lot of old Indian Vedic methods as well. And I realized that there's too much education as we see it may not be the, right way to do it. Given my background in the alternative education space, because I spent 2 years with Steiner School, when I came to VC side, when I came as an investor, and I came across edtech companies which were saying that, okay, there is a 5-year-old kid, why don't you teach him coding? Now, I come from a thought process where a 7-year-old kid is when he is ready to learn, and you're talking about coding to 5-year-old kid. So that was kind of antithesis for me, that putting so much of pressure on children in terms of using technology, using coding, this, that, all the parents want to focus so much of it. For me, that was an antithesis. So personally, for me, investing in ed tech was like, no, I wouldn't want my child to be exposed to technology till at least he's 14. And that's why ed tech was a little bit no-no for me. From the fund's perspective, I think we focus on investing in technology. We talk about technology investments, but from the fund also, we realized that scaling up ed tech, there's so much money which went into edtech in 21, 22, but we've not made any major significant investment in edtech because we realized that the money which is going is not actually going into technology, it's going more into brand building. It's going into selling equipment, devices, rather than actually the technology which is there. There's so much of content which is already available for free of cost that you don't really, investing more to get that content across is did not kind of make sense to us, and that's why we kind of stayed away from EdTech beds. We did make an EdTech investment in 2019 from our first fund, and that was more because we thought the way they're presenting the content made it more interactive and intuitive for children. Or rather school students who were in the age bracket of 8, 9, 10, where, grade 8, 9, 10, where they would understand, and that interaction or intuitiveness of the content will make it easier for them to use that content and, study on those topics. So I think we did invest in a content creation firm. But apart from that, B2C edtech platforms, classes, we've kind of stayed away from it. It also fits into our other investment thesis of not investing in B2C or app only business models or things like that, primarily because you know, we see that there's a lot more funding which is required. You're basically spending money to acquire some revenue, and that's not a sustainable business model, because the moment you stop the spending, you will not be acquired anymore further.
So I want to push back on the I want to push back on your education thesis, maybe not related to your funds per se. So one thing that you mentioned was like how, and I've also seen this where I think when somebody and I think I saw this, I think Bill Gates runs this code.org, or I don't know, I think he's associated with something which is like, I think code.org, where they teach, I think, 5-year-olds or very small children their first exposure to coding, and they like they frame that as an introduction to like coding. So the way I'm looking at it is like, I feel, so my funder is like, why not? Like in the sense, like I feel when kids are growing up, especially at the 3, 4, 5, 6 level, they are generally exposed to a lot of activities. Fancy dress and, you know, talking or something like that. So why not also an exposure to technology as well? It may not be like, you know, code your calculator in like 10 minutes or code your dating app in like 2 days, but simple things like, I don't know, using building blocks to maybe like a small game, I don't know, something like that, I don't know, like Scrappy apps like that. Isn't that like also taking into context, like so much of their future also will be involved in technology, whether they like it or not. How do you think about that? Do you think this is fair? Am I missing something?
Okay. So for this, I will probably rely on my Steiner training and my exposure to early childhood education. I think what Steiner taught us and what early childhood education taught us is that...
Small interruption. So you kept saying Steiner. Could you maybe give us some context as to what that is?
Okay. I'll probably give you a little context. There was a gentleman called Rudolf Steiner. He was based in Germany. At that point, when he was in Europe in the early 1900s, he was there in the early 1900s, he realized that regimentization of education is probably not good for children. He traveled across the globe. He came to India. He went to other places in the world. And then he started a schooling system in Germany. The first Waldorf school, or the Steiner school, was set up in the Waldorf cigarette factory in Germany. That's where the name comes from. Where the focus was on multi-dimensional upbringing of the child. It was more based on anthropology, where you talked about spirit, how the spirit enters the body, more spiritual way of doing education. So that it's a 100-year-old system with schools globally. There are about 15 Waldorf schools in India currently. And we are also looking for Waldorf school as a recognition against your IGSE or CBSE schools. Currently, that recognition is not there in India, but there are about 15-20 Waldorf schools in India. So that's the background. Okay. Now, coming back to your question in terms of why technology, why not have exposure to technology at a very young age. What I feel and what I understand, and this is something which I've actually practically seen with my child, because he was obviously exposed to gadgets like any other normal child at the age of 1, 2, where children use their parents' mobile phones. And then when we started sending him to a Waldorf school at the age of 4.5, we said, okay, no screen time for him from now on. Because that's where we realized, you know, what that is. And we've seen him blossom in a very different way. A child's brain needs to function more. What is coding? Coding is logical thinking put into a particular language, right? The brain has to think logically. the brain's logical thinking has to develop. You don't need to teach a child C++ language to teach him how to learn coding. He has to be taught logical thinking. You don't need computer for logical thinking. You need just your brain for logical thinking. Similarly, I would say, you don't have to teach art to a child. It's the same thing. At Waldorf, we don't teach art. We just allow the child to express his emotion. And the moment you start doing that, you don't teach them, okay, paint straight and then you'll be an artist. It's not how you do it. You let the child start expressing his emotions, and that's how you learn. So I think focusing on developing the logical thinking part, if you want your child to learn coding, I would say that focus on logical thinking for the child rather than focusing on helping him learn XYZ coding language. And I don't think you need computers for developing logical thinking. I give no access to the screen for my child from the age of 4 to probably he was 12. And I feel it has helped him a lot. I have seen him change from what he was when he had access to computer, to a phone or gadgets, and he would spend endless hours of time on that, to what he started doing a lot more things very differently when we did not give him access to those gadgets.
So I know you didn't come for an education session, but I still want to push this a little further, in a sense that so even if I'm sold on that, but the let's say overall this system is like much better than the status quo, but the accreditation, let's say somebody wants to get into Harvard. Now, no matter how smart they are or how much education or how much learning that they have gotten through this system, if they don't have that GPA or accreditation, for them it will be pointless, right? So this not having accreditation will be a huge red flag. You know?
So Ryan, that's a red flag only if you're in India. In India, currently Waldorf doesn't have accreditation. But in Europe and in US, some of the most prestigious schools follow the Waldorf education system. They have clear accreditation. There are more than 1,000 schools across the world. New Zealand board, the main New Zealand board, follows the Waldorf system as their education system. So it's not that okay, there is no accreditation. And specifically for India, for last 25 years, there are many schools which are running this Waldorf system. But what they do is eventually in grade 9 and 10, the children give the IGCSE, the Cambridge Board exams, to get the regular accreditation. Yeah. This podcast is now becoming my views of education rather than the investment thesis, but yeah.
Right. And I still want to push this in the sense that you mentioned that, in the sense that you spoke about how you didn't give access to your kid screen time from age 6 to 12. That is like really huge. Like, I don't know if that is like he had no access at all, he or she.
I mean, he had a little bit of access only in terms of watching movies over the weekends or things like that. But no access to a computer, definitely. He got his first computer. I got a first computer for him when he turned 13, not before that. And he wouldn't obviously access. And yeah, I mean, the phone we had to give when he was 12 because he started traveling alone. But otherwise, we didn't. And I don't think he took it as punishment. He didn't. He was happy without it. He didn't say that, okay, I want this. He didn't come back and say that my friends... Once in a while, he would say my friends in the building play computer games and I don't know what they are talking about. But it didn't matter because they didn't know a lot of things which he was talking about. He started exploring history and probably he studied, he's currently in grade 8, but when he was in grade 6, he knew about history, what kids in class 9 and 10 also don't know. He started researching specific icons in the, you talk about the Mughal era, the Marathas. He started researching those eras so much and he knew so much about them But once when we were in Delhi, he actually could talk to the guide there at one of the monuments and tell him that, okay, what you're quoting is wrong and this is what the actual history is. So, I mean, yeah, it didn't matter. He got the opportunity to explore what his other interests could be.
So one aspect is screen time. Second is like obviously his more depth in history per se. Is there any other way do you think the alternative education part has influenced the way you raise children, which may be contrary to what most people might raise their kids? Or is that the only two things you think are?
I think it is very, very individualistic. When we talk about the alternative method, there are multiple alternative methods. Today, parents are opting for homeschooling. It inculcates when you opt for homeschooling, it has its own pros and cons. I know a lot of people who are homeschooling their kids and they face issues in terms of having the right social circle for the kid because you develop a lot of social skills when you go to the school. But at that same time, when you're homeschooled, you learn a lot more discipline because you have to study on your own. There's no fixed curriculum set as per teacher, and then you have to have that discipline to complete your curriculum in time. So there are pros and cons to everything. What I'm saying is that, okay, this method works for me. It may not work for other parents. So I have a very close friend. She started sending her child to class 6, from class 6 for IIT coaching. I wouldn't say she's wrong. It's just that she thinks differently for her child. Her child goes to a regular school and she thinks it's important for him to go to that IIT coaching. I don't personally feel that requirement for my child. It's very, very, as a parent, it becomes very individualistic how you want to raise your child. So it's very difficult to say, okay, I'm right and everybody else is wrong, or everybody else is right and I'm wrong.
So final question on this one, and then I promise we'll move on. In the sense that I'll take that IIT example as a case in point.
Yeah.
Do you ever think you might get a pushback from your own kids later on that, you know, you did not send them to IIT coaching, plus you did not expose them to technology, plus I'm so different than the other kids? Do you worry about that?
I don't. I will be lying if I say I did not worry about it when he was younger. But now he is in grade 8. He has access to information. He has access to everybody. He has cousins who are studying for IITs and NEET and everything. And he says that I'm happy the way I'm being brought up. I'm happy the way I'm learning. I don't think I'm missing out on anything. As of now, I don't think so. And I think, yeah, I'm pretty sure that at least for my son, he'll not come back and tell me that, why didn't you send me to IIT?
So now let's talk business.
Let's talk business.
Maybe we can start off with what is it like investing in 2023? Your principal, if I'm not wrong, at Inflexor. So what is it like general sentiment of like investing in 2023?
Okay, general sentiment, I would say that, I wouldn't say something has changed very drastically for me or my team. But yes, general sentiment overall, what we see in the environment is we are being extra cautious in terms of investing. Why I say has not changed much is that we've never invested based on sentiments. So when we were investing in 2021, where there were so many deals happening, at points we would, in our internal team discussions, say that, okay, are we missing something? Why are we not able to get convinced on these deals? And why are we not investing as fast as other funds or other people in the ecosystem are? I think our pace has probably remained more or less the same for us. But yeah, I think people have become more cautious in terms of profitability, focus on profitability rather than the market reach. Because I think the early 2021 was about how fast you can reach the market. But I think now the focus has shifted that when you're talking about investment, okay, what is the market you're addressing and where, how can you be profitable in those markets? So that is a major shift. I think that caution that, okay, these businesses have to be sustained because you can't keep funding them has changed a little bit.
Yeah. I think I read today, if I'm not wrong, that dollar value of investments made in India has dropped by 77% or so. So is it like, are we feeling the pinch from both ways where it's difficult to raise capital as well? And also it's difficult to find companies to invest in as well. Is it, are you feeling it both ways? Plus just related to that as well, do you see a drop in do you see a specific drop in some sectors where do you think, the best example I can think of is obviously AI. I feel, I think the companies that are building, the number of companies that are being built in the AI space must have increased. But do you see like a sector-wise drop where, you know, I don't know, healthcare-wise people have stopped building, or fintech-wise people are, do you see anything of that sort?
So, yeah, I mean, if I were to quote a couple of reports, I think I was reading one of the Your Story and Business Insider reports, which talked about 60-65% drop in the investment, which has happened in H1 of 23 versus previous years. And specifically major sectors which were hit were fintech, which were hit edtech, and health tech was another sector which they mentioned. Now, I think a significant amount of investment in 2020 and 2021 went into edtech because the entire growth was flooded with COVID. The moment COVID hit, 2020, education moved online. There was too much of online education happening. Everybody thought that this is sustainable. This is the way to go. This is giving equal opportunities to a larger mass. And there was significant amount of investment which happened in EdTech. However, come 23, people are back to school, people are back to colleges, there's a lot more personal interaction. EdTech has taken a little bit of backseat. And that is why investments, people had to cut their losses in EdTech, and investment in sector like EdTech has gone down. I think these are some of the factors. Health tech, again, there was so much focus on telemedicine. However, now people are back that, okay, I want to meet the doctor face-to-face, talk to the doctor face-to-face rather than use an app and talk online. So obviously the expected sustainability of those use cases have not happened. The moment there is a drop in usage, there will be drop in the returns on that portfolio.
Like, do you think people overestimated do you think people thought, or investors thought, that everything would move online and only online, in the sense, in terms of like telemedicine, right? Like, do you think that the investors thought that people would, it's just more convenient and this is how it's going to land, and you know, the in-person interviews or in-person the term for meeting a doctor and a patient, do you think that would not last for a long time? Do you think that's not turned out to be the case, where people are very enthused about, you know, going to the doctor and talking to them as opposed to, you know, doing that consultation online? Do you think the promise of online has not really delivered?
I personally feel yes, the promise. I think when 2020, 7-8 months, obviously everything was shut and, you know, everything moved online. And people assumed that, okay, we have the comfort of our home. Everybody's sitting at home. And still everything is working properly. So this could be one game changer where you say that, okay, habits have changed. But with after 8-10 months of that, when people became overwhelmed with that, the habit change has not been permanent. It was, I would say, a probably requirement at that point that, okay, you start using more of technology for a lot of your regular work activities, but with that, people want to go back to their older habits. I would want to go to a doctor consultant, ask him to check me rather than just show him my face on the, on the screen. So that gives me more comfort when a doctor checks my BP, gives me more comfort that, okay, he's testing me, he's checking me, rather than just doing my own readings and sending it to him. So I think that has kicked in. Second thing is, I think extreme fatigue kicked in for everybody with screen time. People wanted FaceTime. They don't want screen time. Because everybody was working, whether you're consulting, you're talking to people, everything was on the screen. You know, and that kicked in a lot of fatigue. And that's one of the reasons why things are moving down. I think 2021, end of 2021, I was meeting my ophthalmologist, and what we realized, what the ophthalmologist said, is that in the last 1 year, the number of children patients I've got with myopia has increased significantly, primarily because children had to use screen time. There was no option. And parents realized that, okay, we don't want to give more screen time. Let them do in-person activities. So that's why it hit significantly. There was a big bump in investments in health tech. There was a big bump in investments in ed tech. And then that resulted in the fall in those sectors.
This comfort element you mentioned, not only comfort, but like the familiarity of like when you get an experience, let's say in teaching and healthcare, like I would assume if I was diagnosed with cancer, I would prefer if the doctor would speak to me in person and deliver the news. It'd be weird getting a cancer diagnosis over like a Zoom call. So in the sense that, I mean, at this point in time, it's obviously, when you spoke about fatigue, I think the tech is not there yet. In terms of like, I'm trying to link this to like AR, VR and where it's going. Famously with the launch of like Vision Pro, and obviously I think more investments will be made in the AR, VR spaces as well. But leaving the investments aside, like, do you think we'll reach that stage where, you know, that level of comfort and familiarity that we feel while talking to a doctor in person, any idea you think that might be replicable with like very high fidelity AR VR devices?
I don't know. It's very I think we are a social animal. Humans as such are social animals, and I think we like to have that touch and feel. We like to have the emotional connect, which becomes very, impersonal when you're doing it on a screen. With AR, VR, I don't know, probably the, but I think with the, there are a lot of stuff which is happening on AR, VR, which gives us more, I would say there are multiple use cases to it, but I think in terms of communication, I think in person will still hold its place. So I don't know. I mean, it's very difficult. AR, VR will have probably more use cases in other spaces when you're talking about things like e-commerce, etc. Those are the places where I see more use cases for AR, VR. In health technology, I think AR, VR has more use cases in terms of diagnosis, in terms of, surgery planning and things like that. But in terms of pure play consultation, I would say it's still a long way to think on those things. But yeah, I mean, there is very, very strong use cases in medical diagnostics side, especially for AR, VR.
So one is like the use case, right? But the other part is the core technology itself. So one is AR, VR. But the related, I mean, not related, but I kind of view like developing hardware of AR/VR devices, that's a very technical and that's a very, I feel, a very capital intensive endeavor. related to that is like different industry, like let's say space, right? Space or maybe clean tech, I'm not sure. But space, I think also, like if you're working in the space industry in India, I'm talking specifically about India, it might be difficult. What is your, how would you approach, like, is it, will we be able to build any companies in this space? Like, I mean, or will we only develop, end up developing software for, let's say, Oculus or Apple? Will we be the software guys, or do you think there's any potential for?
No. I think India has a great potential to be both hardware and software guys. When you specifically mentioned space tech, I think space technology, we are building so many things. One of our portfolio companies is working on propulsion systems for satellites. We know we've seen or evaluated so many space technology companies who are building rockets, who are building satellite systems, nano satellites, cluster satellites, and things like that. So I don't think India is purely. So till now, I think the 90s and the early 2000s or 2000 till about 2015s or 20s, India was known as IT services. And I'm talking of IT services, not IT products as well, because we were building software for somebody else. We were supplying bodies to build software. That was where we were focusing on. But in the last 5 years, I think from 2015 onwards, there's been a major shift where we are talking about building product companies. Products as in software products. We are talking about software products, hardware products. We are talking of getting that capabilities to manufacture things in-house. We don't want to depend on other countries for our electronic supplies. We don't want to... The whole mindset of being a software engineer and coding for somebody else has shifted, and they want to develop products from India for the world. So that's why in the last few years, we've seen so many product companies coming out of India. Obviously, scalability is a challenge. Acceptance is a challenge as of now. It's very difficult for an Indian company to be sitting in India and selling a software in US as on date. Do I think it's going to be the same 10 years hence? Probably not, because there will be better acceptance. Today, a lot of companies, in the last few years, we've seen a lot of companies to have good software products flip their structure, where they develop a holding company in the US and the software development happens in India, because they see that it's easier to approach the market, the global market, with a holding company in US. But eventually, it's in the last 2 years, we've seen that there is a bit of change. There's better acceptance. Obviously, going to the US market is slightly difficult if you're sitting in India. You need to have some presence there, because that's the way it is so far. But in the next 10 years, I don't think that's going to be there. I think India is moving from the services mindset to the product mindset. We are focusing on building hardware products. We are focusing on building software products. And that shows in the kind of investments which come to us, the investment opportunities which come to us. We have at least 6 or 7 portfolio companies who are doing software products from India for the world. We have a software product which is doing customer marketing automation. We have a software product which is doing AI for emotion mapping. We have a software product which is working for logistics hubs. So I think the focus has moved towards product companies.
So I feel I know your answer to what I'm going to ask, but I'm still going to ask it. In the sense that, so one is, you mentioned for these hard tech companies, one is like scalability. Challenges like scalability and acceptance, but I want to relate this to the Indian story itself, right? Indian startup story. But I feel one of the biggest challenge with respect adding to the scalability and acceptance is like revenues, right? Or money being made in India. So I feel like there's not much money to be made in India per se, like and. The reason why is like, because I mean, a lot of people just don't have money to like buy services or buy products. So that is like a, like no matter how many people like log into your app every day or every month, if they're not paying for it, then it doesn't matter if you have like 700 million MAUs or 500 million DAUs. Are people being too bullish on the Indian story? Do you think that? And any thoughts on, like, not a question per se, but like, how do you think about this?
Firstly, is there money to be made in India? Yes, there is money to be made in India. I wouldn't say that there is not money to be made in India. I agree to your point that, okay, people are sensitive to pay. They are not willing. The willingness to pay for services has been always on the lower side in India. Willingness to use a software, pay for a software, has been low on the lower side in India. For that matter, India has always been known to be a very, very price sensitive market, even for FMCG products. So I think price sensitivity has always been one of the major factors in India. However, we see that in the last few years, we've seen that people are willing to pay for a premium for a product. There is willingness to pay for a good quality product. And I think that is there. Having said that, I think, are you focusing, I mean, as an entrepreneur, are you going to be focusing only building of a product to make money in India? Yes, you can make money in India. There is enough and more market. I think one of our portfolio companies, and this is something I think I'm probably referring to a lot more portfolio companies here, but I have seen in my portfolio and other portfolio companies who possibly scaled in very, very traditional markets. You know, very, very traditional markets. You say that this market has, there's no disruption for the last 30 years. There were market leaders who were established. And we've had portfolio companies who've come and challenged them. They're not fighting a price war. They have a product which is much more premium quality, premium technology. They're pricing it at a premium price and people are willing to buy it. So there will always be a bottom end of the pyramid and the top end of the pyramid. Do you want to target only the top end? You want to target the whole pyramid is your choice. There will always be very, very price sensitive customers, but I think the willingness to pay has come in where people have realized that, okay, if you want to use a decent software, you need to pay for it. You can't just pirate it all the time. And we've known to be one of the oldest. I think 25 years ago when I got my first computer, it had a couple of pirated softwares. So now I don't know the difference. Would I want to buy a pirated software now? No, I would want to buy it. So I think that mindset has changed a lot. Is there money to be made in India for software companies to scale up in India? Yes, there is enough and more ability. People, businesses are willing to get better quality software to make operations faster, efficient, more efficient. So there is enough and more opportunity to develop products for India.
Is there a company that you really wanted to invest, but for some reason you couldn't? I don't know. Which may be like a big name now.
So I think it is one of the companies which I personally really wanted to invest in, and unfortunately that didn't go through, is a company called Emotix. They develop robots. It's a toy company for, they develop toys as a company, robots as accompaniment to children. It's a product called Miko, Miko robots. We liked the founders extremely well. Very, very smart founder. Unfortunately, we, our IC, it didn't go through the IC. So that's one of my companies. I think it's doing well. It's not scaled to the expect, to the level we would have thought, but it's doing well. Apart from that, I think there are two more companies which we saw where I think one of the companies we saw, the founder, probably one of the most smartest founders we've met till date, but unfortunately we thought he was a solo founder and he needed a tech co-founder with him, and that's why, because at that point, having tech outsourced in a business was just not acceptable to us. So that was another business that didn't go through. Recently, that company has been acquired already. So I wouldn't want to name it. But yeah. these are two examples which like are constantly on my mind. But yeah, there are companies which we've evaluated and they've got funded later. But I don't think any significant regrets in not investing.
With these two companies, like, did you technically, like, not technically, I mean, imaginatively lose like a lot of money in the sense that if you had invested, it would have been like a...
No, we would have made money, but I don't think we imaginatively even thought that, okay, it's going to be a 100x or a 1000x, which we lost.
The first company you mentioned, it didn't clear IC. What is IC?
Our investment committee.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, so once you choose a company that you like to invest, like another committee goes through that investment, is it?
Yeah. So that's our investment process. Typically, if the team likes a company, we present it to our investment company, which has our representatives from our LPs as well. And then they decide that, okay, it has to go through or not go through.
Did you say that you will resign if you don't fund, if they don't fund the company or something like that?
Oh, you don't do that. they are very, I don't think you can do that. I don't think you, I mean, it's more like, you present your case and if the case makes sense, it goes through. If they have certain questions, you answer them. If you're not able to answer their questions, then it doesn't go through.
Any horror stories you have for us? By horror stories, I mean, I don't know, like, you may not have any, but what I'm curious about is, like, I don't know, a company which had like only 3-4 days of like runway, or someone who turned out to be a huge scam, like scam artist or something like that, or like a big, I don't know, any horror stories according to you that might be a horror story.
I would say there are a lot of heartburns. There are situations where we've seen that, okay, we've mentally kind of thought that, okay, this company is gone, dead, now nothing can happen of it. And that companies have come back. So we've had portfolio companies where they were raising capital after 3 years of our investment and they were not able to raise capital. And they were like, we got a couple of acquisition offers which were like, 1/10 of what value we thought the company held at that point. And we said, no, this is not acceptable to us. And the promoters continued. I think the promoters' conviction was so strong in that they used all their resources, continued working on it. And those companies are much more successful now. We've had situation where, you know, promoters have threatened they want to resign. And we said, okay, fine, resign. And then, you know, you talk to them, you understand their concerns, you try to address their concerns, and then, yeah, they continue to working on it. Because for them also, they have put in so much of effort that they don't want that to go waste. So, yeah, I think touchwood, so far from our portfolio, no major frauds or any issues. But, yeah, I mean, these issues happen all the time. Causes us to have a few months of sleepless nights. And then slowly you work with the promoters, you work with the company to make sure things settle down, you find solutions to it, and then life goes on.
I like how casually you just put in that we lose sleep for a few months and moved on.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I think it's very important. I've spent 7 years in this business, okay, and I think I've realized in the 7 years that it's important to not get emotionally attached to your investments. Okay, it has to be a very, very logical and practical decision. When you decide to invest, you should not decide that, okay, emotionally, I like this founder so much that I want to invest in this company. It cannot be that. If you have to write off an investment, you can't say that, okay, I nurtured this company so much, I can't write it off. I will give it everything to make it continue. It is very, very important to be very logical and practical, your decision making has to be based on facts and not on emotions.
So it's like the opposite of dating, is it? Like But like, I don't think that's possible, right? Like, I mean, when you say it, like, it feels really nice to hear it, and it feels like this motivational quote or something.
No,
But
it is not possible. I agree with you. It is impossible that, you're working with a founder, you're working with a company, you see it grow, or you see that it's not growing. And it is not possible that you don't get emotionally attached to it. You have this, it's like your baby. You've worked on it, worked on it. But and that's why I said that you do spend sleepless nights on it, because you are invested in it that much. But I think at some point you have to realize that, okay, there's not much you can do about it. You've done your best, you've taken the most rational decisions, and you have to learn to live with it.
so this is going to show my ignorance as well, in the sense that so I don't know, like, how, let's say when a company goes bankrupt, I don't know if it happens like on a on like I don't know, it happens on a Tuesday evening or like Wednesday afternoon or something like that. Like, it happens at a moment in time. But let's assume for simplicity that it does happen on a moment in time, where, I don't know, you get a phone call saying, "Theek hai, company's closed." Let's assume that's the case. Now, if that is the case, like, on that day, like, what do you do? Like, what is, do you have a ritual for that day where your company didn't work out, or like, do you go to the temple or something like that? I don't know, like.
No, I don't think, as I said, no write-off so far from our portfolio. Yes, you get these phone calls from promoters that, one evening you'll get a phone call saying, so such and such crisis has happened, and you just put your team together, you put your head together, and say that, okay, this is a crisis. How do you resolve it? How do you find solutions to it? You talk to the promoters, you talk to the management team, the second level management team, understand, spend multiple times talking to other people, and give potential solutions and try and find solutions to it. There are a lot of times, one fine day, one promoter will call you and tell you that, okay, I'm not happy working with the other founder. I've worked with him for 10 years, but I don't want to work with him anymore. And you realize that having both the promoters together is important. You work on it, you try and find that how their roles and responsibilities can be split. If the promoter has to be moved out, you identify what happens if he moves out, what are the company's losses, how you the company can recuperate from it, identify how that person's roles and responsibilities can be taken up from somebody else. So you have to, I mean, yes, it is, you will get calls like that. You get crisis situations where promoters come and tell you that this crisis has happened. But I think you work with the team to make sure that you roll over that crisis.
By promoters, you mean founders, right?
Yeah, founders.
Okay. What would you, like, what do you think is like your, for you, like, what do you think is the hardest part in the job or on the job? Like, is it like finding companies, or is it just like, I don't know, operations, or I don't know.
I think for me personally, the most difficult task is guiding the founders correctly. Because when you invest in a company, identify a company, you've made an investment. We are not pure play financial investors where we give the money and forget about it kind of thing. We work together with the founders, help them identify gaps in the organization, help them identify new markets, connect them to our network where they can approach more people. So I think that is the most critical point. We've seen situations where, founders have a different thought process. Some of the investors have a different thought process, and they're trying to pull the company all over the place, and it doesn't help the company's cause. So that alignment of the investor's vision along with the founder is the most critical part. Identifying companies is making, I think, making the right decision, getting your conviction to a place where you can convince your investment committee to invest in a company, that is second most difficult, I would say. I think apart from that, there's a lot of routine work which you have to do over and over again. But these two are very, very, I think there's a lot riding on you when after you have made an investment and also letting an opportunity slip through which you can think and give multiple returns for your investors.
Have you had cases where you had to replace the founder?
We've had cases where one of the founders have moved out and the other founder has continued. We've had cases where we've replaced the CEO with a professional CEO and the founder continues in technology roles. Yes, these kind of cases do come in. I think what matters is ultimate skill sets which the company needs to grow. And whether it is coming through the founder or through a professional coming in because you recommend a professional to come in is completely is more what is more important is to get that skill set.
Do you feel any pressure from the in the sense that pressure from the LPs, like I'm guessing you're the principal, so the people who give you money, like I mean the fund that, so yeah. Any pressure from that side? Like
there is always, you are sitting in a fiduciary duty here. So when I'm sitting as an investment committee member or as an investment team member in the fund, I'm not investing my personal capital. I'm investing somebody else's capital. And that's why I'm sitting in a fiduciary role where I've signed up to give them X amount of returns. Obviously, that pressure is always there. But I don't think that pressure, I mean, LPs ask us questions. So when, as I mentioned earlier also, we did not invest as per the sentiment, and the sentiment in 2021 was so exuberant, and we still did, I think, four or five deals in that year. The LPs were questioning us, why are you doing the deals at such a slow pace? And come to 2023, the same LPs are questioning us, why are you doing deals so fast? Because we've already in the process of closing 3 deals in the year. And we are like, we don't think our deal pace has changed. The emotion or the sentiment has changed. We've stuck to our values. And I think as long as you can justify and have done your work diligently, I don't think you face too much of pressure. But yes, you are ultimately answerable to your LPs.
Right. So so we discussed like founder co-founder relations. Like how do you think about like LP GP relations?
See, LP GP relations is also a partnership. Okay. I think LPs rely on the GP's expertise. They realize that the GPs have that expertise to pick up the right companies, and that's why they've invested in you. And as a GP, you are expected to complete your fiduciary role and make sure you've done your diligent work. We have some of our LPs, we have very close relations. We help them in their evaluations also. Some of our large LPs, they will send us companies, okay, evaluate these companies, or they will send us potential investment opportunities. But when an opportunity comes to us, it has to fit into our investment thesis parameters, If it fits in, it will go through. If it doesn't fit it, then we convey to our LPs that no, we can't invest in this company. So I don't think we have that issue ever that, okay, LP has sent us a company and we have to invest in that. I don't think that's there. It's completely independent that way. Relationship with the LP is, it's a partnership. It's a long-term partnership. We have given, and if we've given sustained returns, I think our fund one is doing well. Fund two is in a decent position as of now. So we hope we continue that same relationship with them going forward also.
I was very intrigued when you said like your LPs would ask you, like, why are you doing too many deals or not too many, like, why are you doing less deals? Like, this reminded me of, like, Warren Buffett. I don't know if this is still the case, but I think Warren Buffett had this rule that you can invest in my, like, you, like, I can manage your money, but you can only ask me, you can take out your money on only, like, the last day of the year, and you cannot ask me any questions as to, like, where I'm investing or what I'm doing. So that was, like... That is weird for me.
No, I don't think that's the case with us. I think with us, a commitment from our LP, we hope the LPs keep our commitment. And because that's basis that only we invest. So I don't think that we want our LPs to withdraw their money from this. And in terms of questions, I think we provide them with all the information on an ongoing basis. Regularly, quarterly updates and stuff like that. I think they have the right to ask their investment questions as long as, I mean, we are doing our fiduciary duty and we have done our diligent work. So I'm sure there should not be issues.
Do you have any aspirations of starting your own fund or I don't know?
Probably someday. No, I think I have grown with the fund. I have been a founding member for them. I was one of the first employees for the first fund in the last 7 years, and I'm hoping to rise to the rank because for me this is like my own fund. So yeah.
okay. Theek hai. So I think you're a CA as well. Any impact of like, is it a pro or a con if you're a CA in investing?
I don't know. I think when I interview people now for junior roles, I ask them if you're a CA, how will you manage technology? But I don't think it's a pro or a con. I think in investing, our team is balanced between, you know, people coming from the finance background, people from technology background. So as long as a team, you are able to evaluate both the technology and the operations and the business side of it, then I think, it helps. I would say for personally, myself, I've always been interested in technology. At some point I wanted to be an engineer. I did not become an engineer for other reasons. My dad's also a chartered accountant. He wanted me to be a CA. So I think personally I've always been inclined towards technology. So that has helped me balance my interest in technology, has helped me understand when I talk to portfolio companies or potential investment opportunities to understand the tech side. And exposure in the business world and the commerce world has helped me better evaluate the pros and cons of a business opportunity.
Is there any background you think that is like very helpful for being a VC? Like, I don't know. Like if you're coming from CS background, you can understand the tech better, or if you're coming from a liberal arts background, you can understand the people better. I don't know.
I don't think so. I don't think that there is any specific which says that, okay, if you're from a technology background, if you're a computer science person, or if you're a finance geek, you know, you can be a better VC. I think it has to be a mix. It is more driven by person's thought process? Can you understand the vision of the founder? Can you understand, and can you make that evaluation? It's very driven. I don't think it is that you have to be from an Ivy League or you have to be from a certain background to be in the VC. I know VC has always been traditionally been a very kootry ecosystem, but I think it has opened up now, and our team has people from various backgrounds. So we have engineers, we have people from commerce, we have people from economics, all the places.